Yay.
This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, and always streaming at rightscast.net. The winner of this episode's critique of their manuscript's first five pages is Kim. Congratulations to you, Kim. You have been selected from all of our patrons randomly, but you've been selected, and now you will get a critique of your manuscript's first five pages from yours truly. If a perk like this sounds like it would be of interest to you, I encourage you to visit patreon.com/rightscast and become a contributor to our programming today. At patreon.com/rightscast, you'll get access to great patron perks like early ad-free access to every episode of our programming and more. So visit patreon.com/rightscast today. That's patreon.com/rightscast. This is episode 30 of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network. Welcome to the RightsCast Network's Novel Approaches podcast, a craft-focused conversation for writers everywhere.
Because writing novels is hard, and we're all in this together.
Hey there, I'm International Book Awards finalist, writing coach, and woods-tethered recluse, R.R. Campbell.
You always come up with the best things. And I'm Maggie Derrick, and I'm an author and an artist. And I'm also the guest co-host of Novel Approaches podcast.
You're not also a woods-tethered recluse, Maggie? Oh, I would have thought you'd also be a woods-tethered recluse.
No, I'm a little bit more of an urban recluse. I like to think of myself, I've always wanted to be, ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be that woman in the neighborhood that all the neighborhood kids are like, I think she's a witch. I think she might be a witch. So that's the kind of vibe that I've been cultivating in my adulthood.
It's an urban space thing. So it's like an urban fantasy kind of witch, yeah. Which, hey, like, that's great. Love it. I'm here for it. And listeners, what are you here for today? Well, you're here for this installment of Novel Approaches, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. And for this one, we're going to be discussing Maggie's favorite topic, not writing synopses, because that was last month. This might actually be a more favorite topic of hers. We're going to be talking about anti-heroes. So how excited are you for this chat?
Oh my gosh. I was so happy that this was like the overwhelming landslide vote, because I'm just going to use this as an excuse to spend as much time as I can talking about my one true love, which is, as everyone knows, is Catra from She-Ra and the Princesses of Power. So in this essay, I will.
Oh my God. Yes. I love it. We're gearing up to go. We're going to go full throttle on it. And it really was, folks. I mean, if you voted in that poll, you already know, but the actual results of this were the most one-sided they've ever been. I think in terms of, you know, soccer, you would call it an absolute drubbing. I've never seen anything so fully weighted one way or the other. This is like Brazil losing to Germany in the World Cup semifinal, like 7-1 or whatever it was back in 2014. I was emotional. I'd just gotten off a plane back from Brazil. I was rooting for my friends, and it was a tough day. So a drubbing, but we came out on the right side of it this time because we've got anti-heroes.
That's right. I was going to say, I think the right team won in this one, though.
Yeah, so I would
Feeling pretty good about it. And what I will say is a throwback to the synopsis episode. I am very grateful that everyone voted for it in the end and dragged me through that, because it wound up being incredibly helpful in my synopsis writing journey. So thank you everyone for dragging me kicking and screaming through that topic.
And hey, there's a plug for that episode too. If you tuned into Antiheroes because you were like, well, I'm just kind of here to listen to Maggie talk about Catra, that's cool. But if you got a synopsis to write, you know, there's episode 29, and I heard there might be 28 other episodes of this show before that one, and like 100 other episodes on this podcast network. So, you know, stuff to give a listen to when you got a few free, oh God, how many hours of programming, Maggie? I can't even imagine. Just like clear your schedule and play it. Yeah, I can't. I should have this stuff on the back of on my hand, like written somewhere, but I don't. What are you going to do? But anyway, hey, you know, I wanted to check in too, because I have had some revelations recently, I disappeared to a quiet cabin in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, which is the woods tethered recluse part of the intro. It was actually the wedding anniversary for me and Lacey, which was lovely. Our second wedding anniversary. Yeah. And we got to spend it without Wi-Fi. Oh my God. Do you remember not Wi-Fi?
Not really. Not well. I mean, I know I was around, but that was, oh God, that was a while right. ago.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I remember when Wi-Fi became a thing. I remember when the internet became a thing. But let me tell you, when you can just disappear into a cabin in the woods and spend your time hiking and cooking over an open flame and like just reading books. I mean, oh my God, it was great. I got a lot of clarity out of it. I've made some big decisions about writing related stuff that I feel really excited about. Some of it's going to be tough stuff, but like, I'm really looking forward to like dedicating myself more to this manuscript I've been working on, this To Have Been Rich manuscript, because it has been ruining me as a person. Maggie, you can probably read the tagline for this manuscript on the actual outline for this episode, but the tagline for this one, folks, is neither of them wants a child, that won't stop them from trying. And it is just like, this is a tough one to write, because the entire thing is, well, what if I made the wrong choice like constantly in my life? I mean, I haven't always made the right choice either, but like, what if I really did it wrong for like the last 15 years? And it's murderous, Maggie. It's murderous.
That sounds like the like millennial nightmare.
Honestly, oh my God. And I'm going so hard.
This might be like, it kind of almost sounds like it's a horror novel, to be perfectly honest, from our peers stand.
Right. I'm going really hard on it though, too. Cause like the whole thing is that you have these three characters. There's like this husband and wife that are, you know, well, they're married, they're husband and wife. And, you know, neither of them has ever really wanted to have a kid, but like in the context of like social pressure and like reaching, you know, it's that idea of the biological clock ticking and like, what is the concept of legacy? But there are so many other things we want to focus on. And then you have this other character who she's very much like, never really considered being a mother, like is open to it ish. And it's just like, it creates, we wind up in a space, man. And I go really hard on like, I'm going hard on theme. I'm going hard. I'm trying to, maybe this is like the millennial novel I needed to write, Maggie. It's a challenge.
It sounds really different from your usual fare too. So wow. Oh God, congratulations yes. for really putting yourself out there. That's cool.
Well, thanks. Gotta keep my fingers crossed that I can pull it off. I feel good, but you know, it's going to be a slog. So, hey, but at the same time, I don't know. We're not here to talk about the slog, right? We're here for each other, but we don't need to focus on the slog because we got to focus on clap anti-heroes.
Let's distract ourselves with some anti-heroes.
That's right. And we're going to have a lot of distraction here. It's time to like rub our palms together, get really excited because we're going to get into the conversation about them here now. If you've never listened to Novel Approaches before, this is the way that these episodes work. We normally take to Twitter and to Instagram and ask listeners, hey, what do you think about the month's topic? And we give you some very specific questions that you then reply to. We take your replies, we get them together for this conversation, and we kind of respond to what it is you happen to think about these topics. And we use that as fuel to kind of get us moving forward with picking apart these topics so we can better use them in our work. So Maggie, our first question that we threw out into the universe was, well, okay, what is an anti-hero? What's an example of one? And we actually have a tweet here from someone, if you want to take it away with that one.
Yeah, this is Jennifer Worrell, our good friend, #author/dementedcamel, yes. Which I still have not gotten to the bottom of. And she tweets at J. Worrell writes, and she says, I'd say it's a reluctant hero, someone you wouldn't expect to save the day, but drags himself into it anyway.
And what, you know, what stands out to me here is I like this idea of a reluctant hero, but I'm not particularly sure that I would say the Venn diagram of reluctant heroes and anti-heroes overlaps completely. Does that seem like a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, my first thought when I read that was not wrong, but not, I don't think the whole story when it comes to the anti-hero. It's from where I've been sitting and what I've always assumed and thought is an anti-hero is kind of exactly what the word itself means. It's someone who kind of embodies traits that are opposed to what we would typically think the ideal hero it is. Like, what are those, when you think of what is a hero, it's brave and noble and willing to sacrifice, etc. So then what do we see with the anti-hero and what makes them anti? Yeah, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I do. And I think, you know, in terms of examples, like I'll throw some out there because I know that like we're going to go really hard on one of your examples here, Shirley, in just a minute or two. But like you might consider someone like, and these are, you know, pop culture-y from the last 10 or so years, you'd have like a Walter White from Breaking Bad. That's an anti-hero. You'd have someone like, I never actually watched this show, but like Dexter, I have to imagine Dexter is very anti-hero-y. Mm-hmm. And then even in like the toon space, so to speak, which I know is where we'll be sliding to in a moment, someone like Rick Sanchez from Rick and Morty, also an anti-hero, because all of these people are like kind of, or for sure, POSs, but you know what? Like there is a little bit of humanity in them once in a while. And I know I personally, when I'm watching something with an anti-hero, I'm like, I'm cheering so hard for that humanity to like break through. And it's just very fascinating mm-hmm. to see like the struggle within those characters. I think that's what makes a good anti-hero anyway.
Yeah. Well, and I think, a few years ago, a while ago, I can't even remember when it was, but I read this really interesting essay about why, basically posing the question, why is it that Superman movies keep tanking, but Batman is the gift that keeps on giving? So, you know, in a cinematic sort of experience, these Batman movies just kept getting churned out again and again and again. And then every time Superman movies would be attempted, they would just flop by comparison. And you, of course, could make the argument about, you know, they're whatever. I'm not going to get into lore because it's not really my field of expertise. But the author made a really, and I wish I could remember who wrote it, because they made a really interesting argument, is that the stories that we consume are really reflective of the times that we're living in. And when you think about Superman's origins and kind of that, I'm going to put in quotation marks, golden era, because it was only golden for a very small select few people, of when he originated, you know, Superman is that hero that really typifies the golden boy, that shiny, noble, perfect hero. Mm-hmm. And if you look around, we're living in a dumpster fire. The world has been a mess, and it's been a mess for quite some time. And so on the flip side, you've got Batman, who's angry and he's vicious, and sure, he's got a code, but he's not friendly. He's dark, he's edgy. And it kind of makes sense when you think about the world that we're living in. You think about the fact that, you know, that hashtag American Dream is, you know, everyone woke up from that and realized it's all been a sham all along. It makes sense that people are gravitating more toward the darker, the edgier, the angrier people, because that's how we feel as a collective right now. And I just thought it was so interesting, because especially right now, if you just even just Googled antiheroes, we're kind of living in a heyday of antiheroes right now. Like you listed off a bunch of really great examples. I'm even thinking about the Harley Quinn property right now. And how she's having a huge hate. She's a villain. She's a canonical villain. And yet she's got these movies. She's got this hilarious animated series. And we're seeing that rise. And we're seeing, because now I'm going to slide into my, into my thing. We're seeing a lot of people really just latching on to those anti-hero type characters. And so even, you know, Harley Quinn, perfect example, because she is a canonical villain. But of course, I mentioned earlier, my one true love is Catra from She-Ra and the Princesses of Power, the 2018 reboot, not the original yowling pun-making villain from the 80s. but, you know, I'll just preface this by spoiler alert for people who haven't watched it. But even though in the beginning of the series, she's written to be the villain, as the show progresses, you realize she's not really, and the show itself is actually a dual story. You almost have dual protagonists. You've got Adora, She-Ra, the golden, shining, quite literally hero, who really typifies all those heroic qualities that we come to expect from our main character. And then you've got Catra, who's angry and messy and forever living in the gray zone, that more gray morality. And she's doing everything for herself. And in the end, their stories, it turns out the entire show is about the two of them and their relationship together. And you see this really amazingly well-written redemption arc throughout the story. But Catra's never the big bad of the show either. There are like two tiers of evil above her. What was really fascinating from the show's, beginning in 2018 to when it wrapped up in the spring of 2020 is anything that you would read online was like, everyone really loves this character. Like, Catra is without question the fan favorite of this show. And why is that? And you saw so many essays and articles diving into like, why are we so obsessed with the bad guy? And it kind of boiled down to it's that anti-hero versus villain. Mm. What is the difference between the two?
And I think that that is a really good question for us to explore. You know, I think that's not one that we put out into the community, but I think that that's probably like I say, we should definitely spend some time talking about that. And maybe that's where we go next with this. I do want to add in a couple of thoughts on some things you said earlier, bringing it back to the Superman idea. And I think one of the reasons that maybe Superman is so not appealing right now is because, and it ties in a bit to that idea of how there was never an American dream, or if there was one, we all woke up kind of thing, is that we've all realized like there isn't a Superman. Like, you want to talk about unbelievable superheroes? Superman is the least believable, because that, like, the very idea of that and the use of Superman as a word that exists outside the realm of comics and film and all of that being applied more generally, that thing does not exist. But we have at the same time these characters like a Batman, or these people who are imperfect, but they're enough for now kind of thing. And that made me think of, folks, hang with me for this one. We don't normally go to this space, but I listened this week to the most recent Pod Save the World, at least the most recent based on the time that we were recording this. And they had a really interesting conversation about Alexei Navalny, and he is the main opposition leader in Russia right now. And he was recently suspected to have been poisoned by Putin's regime. And there's been a lot of fallout from that. Of course, he did live insofar as we know, and he's still out there and everything. But the Pod Save the World guys were talking about how, Navalny, though he is opposition to Putin, who, let's just go there, if we're talking about tiers of evil, well, we have our really big baddie up there. And then we have someone like Navalny, who, though he is generally fighting for a more broadly democratic Russia and just ensuring that it actually, the government reflects the will of the people, he does, for example, hold some cards close to his chest about whether or not Crimea actually belongs to Ukraine, or if he's going to ensure, if he were ever in power, that Russia holds onto it kind of thing. So it's like this, there are these complex characters in the middle that you have to find yourself rooting for sometimes, because you can see the humanity and you can buy in to some of their beliefs. But then at the same time, I don't know, man. Like, what are we looking to do? And I know this is like geopolitical, which is not what you're here for, but it really made me think of that, because we're seeing it in the real world, regardless of how we want to frame it. And then we see it in fiction. And again, to that point, that might be why we're kind of clinging to it now more than ever.
Mm-hmm. That's a good example.
Geopolitics corner. Wow. You're welcome, everyone. There you have it. Novel Approaches episode 30. It only took us to get this far, but Maggie, the difference between anti-heroes and villains, that was a really good thing that you introduced here. Is that something that maybe in the context of Catra, you want to flesh out a little bit more if you've got some thoughts on that? Because I'd really like to explore that space, like I said.
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is something that people tend to get, the line often gets blurred, I think, between an anti-hero and a villain. And people think, well, if I'm writing an anti-hero, do I have to be writing it from the bad guy's perspective? And I don't think that's true at all. I was going to save this for later in the conversation, but I'm sure I can rehash it later. The thing to remember about both villains and anti-heroes is that everyone believes that they are the hero of their own story. Mm-hmm. So it kind of comes down to, what are the motivations? And this is what makes, I think, anti-heroes really relatable and really interesting, is that it's not just a case of, I want to cause harm. So you've got your villain, and I think that's how you know you've got a villain. It doesn't really matter what their motivations are. If their whole end game is like, I want to hurt people and I'm going to take power because for whatever their motivation is, their actions, their desires are as best we can define them, they're bad. And their end game is not good. Whereas antiheroes may do bad things, but their end game isn't necessarily, it might not have anything to do with anyone else. It might not even be a part of the grander scheme. They do bad things, but they're not trying to necessarily end the world, which is, of course, is a funny thing for me to say, given Catra's actions in season 3. So let me compare and contrast. We've got Catra, who is our anti-hero in She-Ra, and then we've got the ultimate big bad, who is a character named Horde Prime. And basically, without like defining the difference between anti-hero and villain, I'm just going to like give you a quick character snapshot of both of them, and I think it'll be pretty evident what's going on here. So we have Catra, who grew up with our main hero, Adora, in the Horde. So they were both bad guys. They were both part of the bad guys in the beginning, raised from babyhood up to be soldiers. And Adora leaves her to join the rebellion and be the big shiny hero. And Catra, who's grown up, abused and neglected and has only ever had Adora, really has this mental breakdown. And she starts to fight for power because it's the only way that she knows how to protect herself from being hurt again. And she's lashing out at Adora because it's essentially just a really dramatic breakup. So we've got her trying to prove everyone wrong, that she is her own character, that she is stronger than everyone gave her credit for, and that, you know, basically having that sort of petty, I'll show you for leaving me, look how great I am type crisis, personal crisis. But with the exception of her epic mental breakdown later in the show, she's never looking to necessarily, and there'll be people who will want to argue with me, but her goal was never necessarily she wasn't looking to hurt anyone. In fact, showrunner Noelle Stevenson says she never kills anyone. Canonically, that never happens. Just making sure you all know she is not a murderer. It's all for her own gain. She's not actually trying to hurt anyone except for Adora, because she's an angry lesbian. And
it's emotional angst,
So much angst. It's delicious. Whereas on the flip side, the ultimate big bad is a character named Horde Prime. And he is such a fascinating and really terrifying character, because not only is he this like galactic colonizer dictator, he's also kind of a cult leader. And so he's got this army of clones. Everyone's connected to this hive mind, and he's got this mission of purifying the universe and putting and making everything in his image. So it's really written off of this sort of like religious extremism and this cult-like sort of mentality. And his idea is just going and around the universe, and he is conquering planet and world after world after world. He is committing mass genocide, all in the name of purifying, air quotes here, the universe and rebuilding it in his own image.
Yikes.
So
talk about tears of evil, man.
Yeah. And I mean, and spoiler alert for the whole story is Adora and Catra coming back together and working together. And of course, realizing that they're in love. It's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately what's needed to conquer Big Bad and save the entire universe. And it's just beautiful, because what happens is Catra has skills, has qualities, and is important to our hero in such a way that she needs to be part of the bigger picture in order for the good guys to do what they need to do. Whereas the bad guy is just forever irredeemable. He doesn't have this quality of recognizing that his actions are bad. He believes in his badness so much so that there's no opportunity for redemption.
We're now only days away from the launch of Kill Your Darling Candle Company's full fall and winter line of candles. If you're into pumpkin spice, cedar, or are gearing up to slay writer's block during this year's NaNoWriMo, Kill Your Darlings Candle Company has you covered. Not only will they have as many as 6 candles available to carry you through the rest of the year, they're continuously developing new scents and keeping their operations sustainable with soy wax, cotton wicks, and custom-fit packaging. So if you're looking to bring a little more light to the page, visit kydcandleco.com today to start illuminating your path forward. Again, that's kydcandleco.com. Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. Candles for the wordsmiths of the world. And I think what's really great about this is we're talking about, you know, almost making this distinction between antiheroes and villains in terms of relatability and motivation, right? Because with Catra, it's like we can understand, we as people know what it is to be doubted. We know what it is to have been scorned. We understand like how that can make you feel and what it might push you to do. And so there's a small bit of relatability there. It just becomes about like, well, what are the means for seeking justice? And what does justice mean to someone who has been in that position? So there's this like total moment of like, oh, I totally get that. Like, I understand where you are coming from. Whereas with Horde Prime, it's like, hey, bud, why don't you take a seat? Because this is absolutely banana pants. Like, there's no actual moment of like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I totally get it kind of thing. It's just very, two very different things. And to use another example, because I brought this one up earlier, think about it in the context of like a Walter White. Mm-hmm. Why does he get into any of that in the first place? It's not because he wanted to make a ton of money. It's not because he always saw himself as being like this drug kingpin. Well, he got into it because he just wanted money for his family, man. He was going to die. He was just trying to leave them a little something because he knew how terrible it would be for them once he was gone financially. And then we see that that's where it started. We understand like how hard of a choice it must have been and how hard of a choice it was for him to make the choices he had to make initially. But then we watch him become a terrible, horrible monster. And you're like, man, I was hoping you could just like get in, get out, make this work. And now look at what you've become kind of thing. And that's what I think makes really, when we see this progression, you know, and I guess in, there's this sort of relationship here between the path that Catra takes and maybe the one that Walter White takes, and that Catra in the end comes around, it seems, and is able to team up with the good folks for good. Whereas Walter White, well, what's the final shot of the show? It's Walter White bleeding out on the concrete because, oh my God, that's the first time I've sworn on a Rightscast Network podcast, whatever. Oh, we're rolling with it. But he's bleeding out on the concrete, right? And we're zooming out because this is it, man. You made your choices and you have to live and die with them. Like, that's the space that we're in. And so you can see how there are paths that antiheroes can take. Some of them turn back to the, you know, capital letter L, T, M, light, and some of them stick with the dark. And there are going to be consequences for that no matter what.
Mm-hmm. And I think you like make a really good point. In fact, sorry, I'm like saying three things at the same time. You make a very good point. You said almost verbatim some dialogue from season three of this idea of, I know, it was really weird. You've made your choice. Now you have to live with it. And I think like when we're really trying to sum up the idea of an antihero versus a villain, it's like not just what are their motivations, but at what point do they realize that they have a choice to make and what do they do with that revelation?
Right.
So, and I mean, it's tricky now that we're seeing a lot of stories being written from a canonical villain's point of view, because I mean, you know, I'm going to come back to Harley Quinn. It doesn't matter how you write it. She's always going to be a villain unless she has some bizarre redemption and becomes a good guy, which could happen, whatever, I guess. I imagine people would be pretty pissed off, but hey, you know, unless that happens, she's always going to be a villain in Batman's eyes. And Batman is always supposed to be the hero, even if he is the anti-hero. But if we're looking at the story, any story that's going to be told from a villain's perspective is going to be tricky, and it's going to be interesting because you're flipping the whole narrative on its head, right? Like suddenly the good guys are the bad guys. And it doesn't matter what the intentions of the protagonist are. They may not be the good guy, but they're the hero of their own story. So it's a really interesting exercise in flipping all of this on its head. But I think it's just, it kind of comes down to those really subtle nuances in a way.
And I think that that's a really good space to take this conversation, because we have, you know, we've gone off script here and I love it. I feel like we're covering a lot of stuff that we probably wouldn't have been able to unpack had we stuck with like the questions that were originally offered to folks in the RightsCast chat. So I want to make a brief pit stop and talk about what makes anti-heroes intriguing, because I think we've already covered some of that, and then really jump into how we can write anti-heroes effectively by embracing, I'm sure, what it is that we are going to get when we talk about what makes them intriguing. So why don't we start here, Maggie? We had another tweet from Jennifer Worrell on what makes anti-heroes intriguing, at least to her, if you want to take it away with that tweet.
She says, "I think I really love the uncertainty. I love unexpected or ambiguous endings or heroes that fail. With a typical hero, you know they'll most likely be victorious. Anti-heroes, maybe. Read and see." A winky face emoji.
And we just covered some of that, you know? Like, with an anti-hero, there are options, right? Like, Batman pretty much always comes out ahead, but Batman often incurs a really steep cost along the way. And you have someone like Walter White, who, spoiler alert, folks, I mean, we're years past the finale, but like, as I said, he winds up dead because he made the choices that he made. Catra, she gets another chance because she's able to turn toward the light. And presumably at the same time, I mean, I haven't watched the show, but I'm assuming that, you know, she does endure her own losses along the way, kind of thing. But
oh my God.
Right. Oh, take it away. Sorry. Take it away if you want to. Go for it.
Oh, okay. So what there's a lot that I love about the show, and there's a lot I love about Catra in particular and the way she's written. She's just such a fascinating, dynamic character. And a lot of what Jennifer is saying here really relates back to, if you were watching the show kind of as it happened and you had to like languish and suffer during the hiatus between seasons, you really felt this, but you've got this really fascinating arc of like, you know, she starts heartbroken and scorned, and she gets worse and worse and worse, like progress to the point where she almost does destroy the entire world and really has this epic fall from grace. And she hits rock bottom, and it takes a lot for her to finally realize, okay, enough's enough. I need to get my together.
That's right. Audio guy Matt, be ready with those bleep buttons. We're pulling them out.
But as much as we get that arc, there are those pauses between the seasons where you just don't know what's going to happen next. And I remember, and the fandom, and actually I had this conversation with a lot of people recently about the ending of the third season. Actually, I was watching someone on Twitter watch and live tweet their experience of watching the show for the first time. And they were in panic mode because they're like, I need to go to bed, but I can't stop watching because this season just ended on a cliffhanger. And I'm like, it's just going to get worse before it gets better. Go get some rest. After season three, I remember like closing my computer and sitting back and being like, I don't know if she can come back from this. She just did something so terrible and so potentially irredeemable that I don't know if she's going to get that redemption. And it was really like emotional as a fan and someone who was really invested in the show. I was like, man, how are they going to bring her back from this? And even then it took a while. They did it. Thank goodness, because I would have been a mess. But that uncertainty was delicious. It was so well done and it was so addicting. So I completely agree with Jennifer. That's a really tasty part of the anti-hero. It's just like, you don't necessarily know if you are going to get that happy ending. And that, again, it's all about taking the traditional narrative and putting it on its head. It's really, really fascinating.
And I think another really interesting thing with anti-heroes is watching how unintended consequences play out, because it seems like in the case with Catra, you know, there is this realization that, oh no, what have I done? It's kind of the idea that you're flying toward the sun and then realize that your wings were made of wax. And it's like, well, what was I going to do when I got the sun? Or you get to the sun and realize, oh my God, it's the sun. I'm on fire, kind of thing. So there are consequences for success. And another show that makes me think about that I can't believe I did not think of until just now is actually Mr. Robot. And I don't know if you've watched that one, but man, Mr. Robot, another really solid one for the first couple seasons. I actually don't think I ended up finishing that show. I should probably go back and do that. But I mean, the idea is that you have this hacker and what becomes like a group of hackers that's being led by this guy whose whole thing is, it's like kind of anonymous adjacent, where the idea is that if we can hack into the world's banking system and eliminate all consumer debt, we will literally liberate like an entire generation of people from, you know, the machine. If we're going to take this back to episode 29 and talk about Rage Against the Machine kind of thing. And spoiler alert for that show, you know, the idea is that by the end, I think, of season one, he accomplishes that, but there are so many ramifications for it that he had not considered. And having done so, he's of course made a lot of really intense, very powerful, angry enemies. And watching that play out is super interesting. So he's like, hey, here's a guy who had an idea and he pursued it and he succeeded. And now, oh my God, look at what this has done to other people, including some of the people that he thought he was helping. And so you can see again, like the complexity, I think, is what makes anti-heroes so intriguing. It's the moment that you can be rooting for them. One moment you can turn the page and be completely mortified by them. It's just like every page is really contributing to the roller coaster ride that is experiencing the media they're in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a really, yeah. I love that idea of the unintended consequences, because it's just such a fun thing to explore as a reader slash viewer, but especially also as a writer. Like, it's just it gives you so much room to play. And I think I'll save that for, I don't know. Maybe we're at that next part of our script.
I was just going to say, we're ready. We're talking about how we can write them effectively. I mean, yeah. It seems like we've got a good direction for that. So why don't you just take it away with what you were thinking there?
Well, I was just, so I haven't traditionally written a lot of antiheroes in my original fiction, because I think it requires a different type of mindset, because you really have to break yourself away from some traditional tropes and some traditional storytelling. It almost feels like it requires a flexing of a different muscle, because you really do have to take all of everything you know and just like shake it up. At the same time, it becomes a really fun exercise. It's like you suddenly have the entire playground to yourself, and you're like, okay, now what am I going to do with all of this? And so it's kind of an exercise for myself, because I don't typically write a lot of morally ambiguous characters. As you know, you've seen my incessant tweets about it. I write a lot of fan fiction. And in every case, you know, I always gravitate back to Catra. And it's been such a fascinating experience and experiment in really kind of giving myself this safe, low stakes place to play around and learn how to write these morally ambiguous characters, because she's got so much depth and there's so much going on there. And so I'm, for the first time in my life, and this is someone who like grew up reading and writing fan fiction, is the giant weeb that I was. And still kind of am. you know, I never wrote alternate universe stories, and I never really rooted for the villain as a kid. And now I'm the complete opposite. And so I'm writing this alternate universe story that is kind of set in a contemporary way, but you've still got that same dual protagonist, the hero and anti-hero in Adora and Catra. And it has been so interesting and so fun to write Catra's half of the story, because it's like, ooh, she has to be bad for a while. And I have to really make sure that her motivations are believable. I have to make my reader mad at her, but also not so mad that they give up on her. And so I'm at this point in the story where like she's really flexing her bad guy muscle. She's really like, she's gone from being someone that they really relate to and think is funny and really loved at the beginning of the story. And I'm saying they, because I'm posting this all obviously online, and I'm getting to watch my readers' reaction in real time. And it is so fun. Like, I'm having the time of my life, honestly. So at the beginning of the story, you see everyone being like, she's so great. This is so funny. I love her. She's so sassy. And then you start to see her like becoming the bad guy of the story. And they're like, no,
it's just agonizing.
They're like, I don't want her to be bad. And I see so many of those comments of like, I know she's got to be the villain for a while, but I hate this, but I love her. And you literally see their like moral conflict of like, I love her, but I love the character, but I hate her actions. And this is hurting so much. And I'm sitting here laughing to myself, cause I'm like, it's going to get so much worse. But I also know that she's going to get redeemed in the end, but that is so fun to toe that line. And it's challenging because you really, like I said, you don't want them to lose faith in her. And I think that's the trickiest part about writing an anti-hero is whether they're kind of like casually anti-establishment or they are full-blown, I'm writing a story from the villain's perspective, you have to make sure that your reader doesn't completely lose faith in them. And they have to really flirt with that line of morality, of how far can they go and will the reader still be rooting for them when they cross it? And so that's, I think that's perhaps the most important thing that you have to keep in mind when writing an anti-hero, because if your reader loses faith in them, then they're not going to care. They've lost their investment and they're not going to want to follow them to the end.
This episode of Novel Approaches is brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing. Dandelion Web Marketing helps writers like you build a thriving author platform through strategic web marketing. If you're not sure if you're on the right track with your website, one of Dandelion Web Marketing's author website audits can help you find out. And right now, listeners to the Writescast Network can take 50% off one of these audits. And when you take half off one of these audits, Dandelion Web Marketing will look at your site's content, its security, design, search engine optimization, and more, and they'll provide you with insight into what you might do to better connect with your audience. So to learn the strengths and weaknesses of your current website and save 50% along the way, visit dandelionwebmarketing.com/rightscast. That's dandelionwebmarketing.com/rightscast. And those are all extraordinary points. I mean, you really just, I think, ran the gamut on that one and covered a lot of what it is that we want to strive for if we want to write effective antiheroes. And I particularly love that final idea of we have to get those antiheroes to be able to walk up to a line but never truly cross it. Because if they do cross the line, I mean, there are unforgivable things in readers' eyes that then take that antihero and make them into a villain. And if they can't come back, well, we lose this space that we were trying to create to play in. And I think that one of the things that I did want to bring up in the context of, you know, how it is that we can write them effectively is that I think anti-heroes, more than perhaps any other character archetype, are the best when they are raising questions that will follow a reader or a viewer away from the book or from the screen. You know what I mean? They need to be getting these moral dilemmas on the page. They need to be the people that tussle with the really hard choices because, again, whether they came from the light and are trending dark or they came from the dark and might be trending light, whatever the case is, we have to kind of understand how complex and how complicated their thought process is. And by being with them, as we see them endure all of this, the idea is then that it's going to raise these questions that we as people then have to tussle with, not just in the realm of fiction, you know, that's the context we're talking about this in for the show, but just in our lives too, you know? And I think that that's what can also really make a really effective anti-hero on top of all the other great things that you said there.
Yeah. I like that idea of just something that follows you and really, cause I don't know. I've definitely spent more time thinking about anti-heroes outside of the media that I'm consuming than I ever have, like your classic good guy. And I'm not sitting here, I'm not here to say like, forget the classic good guy, forget the shiny hero, Boo. Because like I said, that's kind of all I've ever written.
And I think that you need all of it, right? You know, think about it even in the context of let's go into the realm of like Dungeons and Dragons, right? And talk about alignment. Well, if everyone on your team is lawful good, it's going to be kind of I would think a more boring campaign. And if we're thinking about lawful good as your true classic, like Superman kind of character, well, okay, you're always going to know what comes next, but when are you going to have the sort of group dynamics that affect your ability to proceed? What's going to happen when you encounter situations that, you know, would require you to perhaps think more longer term and it would require you to like break the law kind of thing? Like in our fiction too, well, if everyone, you know, aside from our one bad villain is just like your good old golden era, hey, look, I'm here to save the world protagonist. Well, you know, then what are we doing? And in that same regard, we can't have all anti-heroes either. So they all have a role to play. So yeah, we certainly wouldn't want to advocate that like, oh, get rid of the good old shiny protagonist because we need them too. They just all play like a distinct role in the broader tapestry of assembling a cavalcade of stars, you know?
Mm-hmm, definitely. And it just, it comes back to just sort of what do that we kind of, I think as readers and consumers of media, we really gravitate back towards characters that we see parts of ourselves in. And mm-hmm. that was one thing that I saw come up again and again, where Catcher was concerned, is I would see posts from people saying, you know, this is the first time I've really seen a female character be allowed to be messy and to really make these kinds of big epic mistakes and to be so emotional and still and not be completely vilified and pushed off to the side because of those emotions and those character traits. And so a lot of people were saying, like, I really, really relate with her, even though she's supposed to be the bad guy. And there was a lot of angst kind of halfway through where it's like, God, I hope that she gets to have some kind of happy ending. Cause if she doesn't, what does that say for me?
Oh yeah. As wow.
Really relates with her. And I remember there being a point of time, I was participating, sitting in on one of the many digital panels that were happening as the show was ending because COVID was here and it ruined everything. And I submitted a question and I was just like, please just tell me that she's going to be okay. I see so much of myself in this character, and if she's not okay, then I gotta reevaluate my life.
God, that's, yeah. So, I mean, and it's tough. And that's the whole thing, is like when it follows you away from the page, when it follows you away from the screen, and you develop these like very personal, complex relationships to those characters. I mean, that could be a good sign that you've got an anti-hero there. Because, and actually, let's think about it, if you as a reader or as a viewer of film or television only ever find yourself identifying with the Supermans of the world, that's something that we should probably unpack, like, you know, in a therapy session, maybe, because I just think about like what that means for our self-image, right? And who it is that we believe we are as people. And, you know, the same applies too. If you only ever see yourself in the villain, I mean, like the true deep, dark villain, that's a whole nother thing, right? But we, most people, understand what it is to have to make difficult choices. We understand what it is to have not always been like our brightest, shiniest, like wonderful, most lovely person to every other person we've encountered all of the time. And that is why I think that this ties into the previous question again, but it is part of what I think makes anti-heroes so fascinating. It is that idea of relatability that we keep coming back to here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll ask this, Maggie, of you, if you would like to share, please go ahead and let listeners know, where can they find the alternate universe stuff you're writing for Catra? What's it called? Give yourself a shout out.
Sure. Yeah. It's called One Perfect Year at Stevenson High. And it is available on both Wattpad and AO3. And then you can also just search hashtag Gleera, because it all started as kind of a crack fic idea that took on a life of its own. And so it's She-Ra meets Glee, which sounds absolutely bonkers, but has been a delight to write. It's such a good palate cleanser when I'm working on my own stuff, to just be like, and now it's time to dip into this bonkers weirdness and just have some fun with it. And as it turns out, people agree. And it's really kind of picked up a lot of steam, which has been hilarious to watch. So yeah, One Perfect Year at Stevenson High.
And search for hashtag Gleera over Gleera on Instagram, and you might uncover some of Maggie's art also. Just, you know, putting that out there.
Sure will. Well,
you can leave it at yup. That's fine. It's out there for sure. And I'll say this, you know, in a little contrasting, you know, mood wise, if you are someone who's interested in reading a book full of anti-heroes, might I recommend, I'm going to put on my Yarnsworth voice. Are you ready for this, Maggie? We're going to go full Yarnsworth for a second.
Yes. Okay.
Might I recommend picking up a book from your local bookseller called Empathy, Imminent Dawn, the International Book Award-winning novel by none other than R.R. Campbell. It's full of anti-heroes, some heroes too, but as we are talking about anti-heroes, well, this is the space in which we will play. So Amazon or any of those other lovely local folks who are peddling books to you, anti-heroes folks, Imminent Dawn, check it out. I'm done with Yarnsworth for now.
You should really one day play around with the idea of voice acting, because that was rad. I enjoyed that.
Thank you. I'm now, this is a D&D thing, folks. It's an off podcast topic, but my Dungeons and Dragons character is Yarnsworth, who is a tabaxi bard, which means he's basically like a cat person, a la maybe Catra, but he is very, imagine like combining Team Rocket with Moira from Schitt's Creek and I don't know, something along those veins. He's classically chaotic and he's really just here to, I'm here to tell your story. Don't worry about me. Meanwhile, he's like plotting his own, you know, glory in the background.
Oh my God. What an amazing combination of characters. Also, let's talk like anti-heroes, Schitt's Creek. What a perfect example.
Oh yeah. Good point.
Like they are like your classic, when you start watching the show, there's nothing likable about them aside from the fact that they're hilarious. But they're not good people.
They're definitely not. And what I love, that show actually does an exceptional job, like really making sure that you are never, I don't know if it's the case that I've ever found myself rooting against the Rose family, but there are certainly times where I'm like, oh my God, you just need to get it together. And I think that maybe that's a space we can play into with anti-heroes, where it's not like, oh, you need to hope that they fail or flounder all of the time. It can be just a genuine interest in like, I need you all to put on better faces and just be more aware of the people around you and stop thinking like so limitedly or whatever the case is, and still kind of like cheer for them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You want them to be better.
Yes. And what I think Schitt's Creek does, again, spoiler alerts, folks, I guess I still have two episodes of the series to go before we're done, but it's like, the idea is that over time they do trend better and it's so rewarding to see it. And it goes from a show that's like, oh, this is funny and it has its heartwarming moments, to like, oh my God, there is so much I love here. And it's like, this is supposed to be a comedy and here I am crying. Like, I need to watch this again, you know?
Yep, absolutely. This is like a masterclass. Oh God. Yep, I'm gonna watch it again.
One to watch. Get it on your list, people. It's very good. Also, Dan, is it Levy or Levy? Dan Levy, I believe.
I've always said Dan Levy.
Okay, and I think it is. I should know this because for what I'm about to plug, over on the WTF podcast that Mark Maron does, he actually recently interviewed Dan Levy, and it's really interesting to hear him talk about the advent of Schitt's Creek and the direction that they wanted to take it. And it actually might give listeners to this show some insight into, though he never uses these terms in the interview or the conversation, what you can do to create like a cast of anti-heroes without actually approaching it from the standpoint of, well, I want to write anti-heroes. It's like, no, they just happen to be because of the direction the show wanted to go. And so it's just, you know, maybe another way to consider approaching it if you want to hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. Dan is such a smart, smart person. He has so many interesting things to say when it comes to like just his creative process. So, I mean, any chance you get to dip into that well, I take it, because he's really good.
And I have to do this now because I can't contain myself, but...
Oh, God.
You, David.
Ew, David, no. David, oh, my no. God, Alexis. Okay, I'm fine. Yes. I'm good.
A little bit Alexis. Just a little bit Alexis, you know? all right, we got to rein in this horse here. Okay, we got one more question that I want to hit, because this is something actually you were starting to alluding to a little bit earlier. One of the questions that we did ask folks for the RightsCast chat was, what are the risks we run when we were writing an anti-hero? And, you know, I had an idea of the kind of responses we might get to this, but we actually had one really exceptional reply that came from Rachel A. Writes over on Instagram. And Rachel in that is, that's the handle. It's Rachel A. Writes, but Rachel is spelled R-A-C-H-A-E-L. And Rachel said this. This is about, again, risks we run with anti-heroes. Well, if they're women, they tend to be held to a higher standard, eyes emoji. Example, a male antihero is more likely to be liked. And I thought this was an amazing point for some of the reasons that you brought up earlier. Maggie, I don't know if you want to flesh those out again before I try to take a crack at this, because I thought it was just a really wonderful thing to put out there.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to is when I was talking about how refreshing it was to see a character like Catra, who is allowed to be messy and angry and morally ambiguous. Because Rachel is right. There's this expectation that kind of like for an antihero, if you were to look at Bruce Wayne being driven by the murder of his parents as a child, you know, everyone finds his rage and his anger super justified. And yeah, of course he's allowed to like lash out and become this dark hero. But on the flip side, for a female character to have that kind of emotional gut punch reaction to some kind of trauma, there's this kind of expectation, the dialogue that tends to happen around it is like, well, you know, she's overreacting, or, you know, she needs to just figure it out and get it together, or she's just being emotional, and kind of the same kinds of arguments that we see in real life about, right. you know, women are too emotional. Women need to just be better. And yeah, it can be challenging if your goal is to write a character that people relate to and root for, and you have this kind of inherent misogyny, whether it's intended obviously or not, about the character's response and how it kind of defines them, it becomes hard to root for them because you've been trained to think of it as a bad thing. And so those unlikable qualities that really work for a guy just makes, and therefore makes him like interesting and fascinating and deep, just makes the female character irritating and unlikable. I actually have this t-shirt that I love. An author named Courtney Summers designed it and put it up online. It just says unlikable female protagonist. And I wear it with pride because that's I'm great. Like, yeah, yes, absolutely.
I want that shirt. Come on.
I think there's variations of it. I'll find the link. I'll send it to you.
Oh yes.
It comes back to the same sort of things that we face in real life and just the double standards. And it really can be tricky. And I think what worked really well for Catra's character development is that she existed in a universe where predominantly the entire cast was strong female characters. You know, the rulers were all women, the heroes were almost entirely women, and there was no, like, misogyny was not a thing. It just didn't exist in this universe. And so she was able to really be herself without like being held up against a different type of like ideal female character. Despite the fact that there were polar opposites to her character in the show, it just kind of leveled the playing field a little bit. But it is something that in other pieces of media, other stories that we write, we do have to unfortunately consider the fact that there are going to be some people who just rail against a female anti-hero just because of these inherent biases. And it kind of sucks. You know, it really sucks.
It does. But, and your spelling it out here actually made me think of what I think could be a really solid parallel to demonstrate this to people who might want to try and dig in and say that this isn't a real thing, because we all know that those people sadly exist. So sorry, listener, if you're one of them, strap in. And I hope this really makes this point for you. But think about, we're going to bring this back to Breaking Bad, and then think about a show called Weeds. If you remember Weeds, mm-hmm. Well, what was Weeds? Weeds was a similar story, but it wasn't meth. It was marijuana. And it had a woman as the anti-hero in that, the primary, you know, anti-hero, the driving force of that series. And what happened to those two series? I mean, a million things, right? You can't control for changes in writing or, you know, whatever production or who's doing what in terms of show running, et cetera. But I know that there was a turning point somewhere, maybe around season 3, season 4 with Weeds. We started to hear a lot of people talking about how, like, well, the show was falling apart and, you know, they don't view it with the same sort of, you don't look back on a show like Weeds the same way you look back on a show like Breaking Bad. And again, you can't control for writing, et cetera, but we have to imagine, was the issue that people eventually thought, well, if we got too dark with this anti-hero who was a woman, that maybe it was contributing to some people's inability to suspend disbelief? Maybe. Maybe that was part of it. And I don't know. I can't pretend to say that I even finished watching Weeds. I think at the time I lost my subscription service to whatever it was and just never went back to it. But I think there's something to be said for that. And I can't think of any two shows that can compare so closely one to one as those two, with trying to tease out the difference between the idea of this male anti-hero and the female anti-hero and the sort of risks that we run when we're making that as a creative choice. And that's not even something that necessarily we as the author or as the writer can control for. We can't always control for perception, but we can choose to take on these challenges and try to, like, let's say we want to write an anti-hero who is a woman and who kicks a lot of ass. Like, obviously we see that there are cases where that certainly works, but it's just, again, it's this higher standard thing and it permeates every aspect of our society. And it's just, we have to be, oh my God, I'm swearing again. We have to be aware of it. It's like, what are you going to do? you know?
You know, if you really want to see that one-to-one in the same show, I was blown away by this. House of Cards.
Oh my God, you're right. How didn't I think of that?
House of Cards, and you got Frank and Claire Underwood, especially with the final season after Kevin Spacey was pulled from the show, and justifiably so. And the final season is entirely from Claire's perspective as she kind of takes up the mantle. And people, pardon my language, canned it. And they were coming up with all kinds of excuses to hate it. So I watched it and I was like, she's doing exactly the same that Frank was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Truly, if you were just to swap them out, you wouldn't have thought twice about it. But suddenly the fact that it's Claire, suddenly the fact that it's her instead of him, all that same behavior that you're ripping and picking apart is not okay, but it was okay when it was him.
Right. And I think too, the incredible thing about that is I was super into House of Cards for those early seasons. I did end up watching the whole thing. And I got to say, watching that final season, I think it was the end of the very first episode of that season where Robin Wright as Claire, you know, kind of takes over. And I got chills when that first episode ended because I was like, oh my God, Robin Wright is nailing this. And I was so excited to see what they did with it. And I think that given that they were up against this sudden scramble to rewrite an entire season, there was only so much that they could do. But underneath all of it, like, yeah, there were going to be elements of misogyny that permeated the evaluation of the work, despite just still, the production value, incredible. Robin Wright, how could you ever complain about what it is that she does with any of the characters that she takes on? And yet. So, I mean, that is like, that's an even better example than my, you know, sort of conjured Breaking Bad / Weeds comparison, because it's like you say, it's within the same show and you just swapped one character in for the other in literally the same role.
Great. But no, your example was great too. I loved it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. We're doing the best we can. We're doing the best we can, listeners. This is a longer episode, I know. So thank you for staying with us for all of that. I think, Maggie, it's probably worth touching on just like a couple quick here. Actually, first, before we get to our main takeaways, quick reminder, folks, Patreon, you know it's a thing. Hey, we still got a Patreon, patreon.com/rightscast. You want to get in on Rightscast Network swag? We've got a raffle that we do for the first 5 pages critique of your manuscript. It's all available to you. You can contribute at $1, $2, or $3 per episode or per month. We appreciate anything that you can throw out there. That's patreon.com/rightscast.
Yeah. And if we'd also like to give a special thanks to Laura Hazen and Angeline Boley, whose contributions at the Wise Mentor level earn them shout outs in every Rightscast Network episode, on top of all those other great Patreon rewards that they receive that you mentioned earlier.
Oh yes, and I only mentioned but a few of them. So folks, if you want to learn more about what's available, you get these episodes early and without ads. In fact, so that's another perk, but you can learn more about all of that at patreon.com/rightscast. But as I was winding up to before, let's do a couple quick takeaways here before we close this one out, because I think we've covered a lot of ground here. But Maggie, anti-heroes, what are your main takeaways in trying to write them effectively, what they are, whatever you want to say on this one?
That they're rad and I really love them.
They are anti-heroes are the future. They are the now.
They are everything. But yeah, I really can't stress enough that when you're trying to write an effective anti-hero, you just really have to remember that regardless of their motivations and what they end up doing and where they even end up, they think that they are the hero of their own story, because we are the main character in our own story. So if you're writing anything from someone's perspective, even if they hate themselves, even if they think that they are the worst, they're still the main character in their own story and they have motivations that drive them for a reason. It's really important to make sure that there's something about them, even if they are, you know, gross and awful, there has to be something about their story that your reader can connect with. Because otherwise, how do you expect your reader to follow them? And how do you expect them to be invested in where things wind up for them? So making sure that their motivations are believable and make sense within the context of what you're asking your reader to do mentally and emotionally is really going to go a long way to help you. And the good news is there's a lot of great material out there to give you inspiration. So stream She-Ra and the Princesses of Power on Netflix.
And then, you know, like follow Maggie on Instagram, on Twitter, you know, read the One Perfect Year at Sweetens and Pie. There's a lot of content, folks. There's a lot of it out there for
you. There's so much of it. Oh my God.
And, you know, we did focus a lot, I think, on TV and film today, because I think those are the most readily accessible. You know, again, it's passive media versus the sort of active media that we get in the world of books. But these characters are out there. You know, one series we didn't even touch on at all is, of course, A Song of Ice and Fire, you know, any of the Game of Thrones stuff, which I know we're all super over now. I for sure am. But that's, you know, thousands and thousands of pages of stuff that you can pour into to dig in more into what an anti-hero might look like and how our opinions of them can change over time. Maggie, dare I say that some authors have themselves become, well, some of them have become downright villains now, but there are plenty of actual authors out there who have sort of entered this sort of like anti-hero like space. Oh, it's so much. That's a whole nother episode we could do. But basically the point is this, folks, you know, with anti-heroes, like Maggie has said, like I've said in this episode, we want to get them walking up to a line. We want to be able to understand where they're coming from. Maybe they make some choices that we wouldn't make, but we understand why they're making them. And then we see how it plays out. You know, can we get questions to be raised that follow our viewer, that follow our reader from the page and from the screen? And then they are engaging with your content, they're engaging with your book, your script, your screenplay, whatever it is, they're engaging with it after they have set the book down or turned off their TV, whatever the case might be. So I think that these are all really interesting things to focus on as we're running anti-heroes. And Maggie, good one today. Feel really good about this one. Thank you, Maggie. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us for this episode of Novel Approaches here on the Rightscast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. If you liked what you heard, we'd love it if you could leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And for more writerly podcast content like this, visit us at rightscast.net or follow us on Twitter at rightscast. And, you know, if you liked all my ranting and you really want more Catra content, I am your peddler. So you can follow me on both Twitter and Instagram. Twitter at Maggie Derrick, Instagram at Maggie.Derrick. Come say hi.
A peddler of She-Ra and Catra fan fiction. Yes, Yarnsworth very much approves. Oh, wow. I tried to do my aha laugh, but I squeaked. Oh, my God. My voice squeaked. Terrible.
I love it.
Oh, let's put it aside. I got to save it for D&D. That's tomorrow night. Anyway, R.R. Campbell, not Yarnsworth. I'm on Twitter as I am R.R. Campbell. Thanks as well to everyone who participated in the Rightscast chat. You know who you are, Jennifer and Rach. We appreciate it very much. And next up on the Rightscast Network, I will be interviewing J. Scott Coatsworth, who joins me to talk about Facebook for authors. It is technically social media month here at the Rightscast Network. So aside from this episode, mostly social media focused, so you can get a lot from Scott in that episode, which will debut 1 week from the debut date of this episode.
Cool. And I guess that's it for this episode of Novel Approaches. Thank you for listening.
Yes, that is it for Novel Approaches indeed. So thank you, everyone. Until the next episode that we have here on the Rightscast Network, you know what to do. Write on and write well.
Yay.
This is the Rightscast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, and always streaming at rightscast.net.